cultural conditioned perspective. And so the Buddhist teaching is a teaching aimed at pointing at the ultimate reality, at the unborn, unconditioned, at Dhamma. And from there, once we respect that, then, and recognize that and appreciate that, then we can deal with the conventions of the societies we live in, and whatever they might be, with language, with concepts, with memories, and all the rest. And so, coming into Buddhism as an adult, then training in Thailand, totally different environment from what I was accustomed to, learning a new language and living in a very conventional, very strict form, then of course this, and then having to learn another language, the Thai language, it also made me much aware of the how I related, how I used, how I or misused the English language. So, and then coming to England to live and to teach people here, teach the Dhamma people in this country, and having learned really the practice of meditation, learned Dhamma through the Thai language, using from my experience with Lungpa Cha, then I began to really struggle to try to find the right English equivalents or for communication, for using the language for communication, for as a skillful tool rather than just as a habit of thought or just taking for granted that because English is my first language that somehow I understand and use it skillfully. As we all know, speech is one of the most difficult things to write. Speech is one of the more difficult ones to cultivate. And as a monk or a nun in the Sangha, it's a real challenge to cultivate right speech, because even though we don't hit each other, we try not to abuse each other in any way, language can be used, and sometimes just for habitual proliferating, gossiping, it can be used as a way to insult or to intimidate others or to bully them or to define them, project our own views, believing our own views and perceptions of somebody as the real person. So in this context, the Buddha, in the context of the sangyojanas, the 10 sangyojanas, the first three are the fetters that bind us to the world, the manacles, the handcuffs that trap us in the worldly habits. So putting into perspective that when we're born, when a baby is born, it is, it doesn't have a language yet, doesn't have an ego, doesn't see itself as good or bad, or boy or girl, or Thai, or English, or anything else. These are perceptions that one acquires after birth. So this is a significant reflection that our personalities, the sense of our self-worth, our values, our principles, habits, and all that, come after birth. We're not born with them. We might inherit tendencies through the genes of our parents and heredity, or maybe previous lives. Who knows? All the things affecting the birth of a child. But in terms of culture, the cultural attitudes, the ego, the sense of a separate self, and the use of language, say a newborn baby doesn't have these yet, hasn't developed, has no way of thinking about itself through language or through identity with the body. But it is conscious. It's a conscious human form. It has a human body, and it's conscious. So what I'm doing now is reflecting on the way it is. You know, so the, just beginning to see a baby as a, and we were, you know, we all started out with that sense of innocence. Children, you know, they're quite innocent. Babies are, you know, they're not malicious monsters, even though sometimes they might seem like to a tired mother, exhausted. But we probably project that onto them. But they do have intelligence. They have instinctual intelligence. They know how to let us know their needs and ways of surviving. So it is a human form, a body, consciousness, and then the rest, the sense of a separate self, is instilled in us through conditioning, cultural conditioning, through reward and punishment, values of the ethnic group, religious identities, age group, identities with the gender, with being male or female, and the attitudes and that a particular culture has about these perceptions. Now, the language, remember, is we have this ability to think and to proliferate in thought. And this is a critical function because thinking is all about discrimination. It's the discriminatory ability that we have to say, oh, this is better than that, or this is beautiful and that is not, or this is bigger and that's smaller. We have label colors, yellow, blue, red. We point to the male and the difference between the male and female. We identify with maybe social status, whether we're high status or low status. We identify with the ideals of a society, of how things should be, of principles, high principles and ideas. We can develop, through education, a lot of knowledge about all kinds of subjects. We can develop musical talents, dancing talents. Maybe we're prone towards mathematics or science. But all these are acquired knowledge after the baby's born. And then the basic conditioning as a child, as a baby growing up, is the identity, the sense of oneself as I am this body, I am this personality, I am a boy, I am a girl, I am a good boy, a bad boy, etc. It goes on into the usual rewards and punishments and ideals and identities of particular cultures. So in this room at this time, there's many from different cultural backgrounds. So we not have all the same cultural attitudes, basically, that we might all agree in many ways on principles and that. But on the cultural conditioning, that's the conditioning acquired, not through intention, but through just being born into the family, into the place, into the situation that a baby's born into. So it's born into very kind, good parents with status, or it can be born into a really mean, nasty, coarse family, or just be born and become an orphan or whatever. So these different conditions do affect the sense of ourself, you know, our confidence, our sense of self-worth as a person. So, say the first fetter then is personality or sakkaya ditti. And it's very important to see that this is the biggest obstruction we have towards enlightenment, towards seeing the path, is this separate identity. And it's insidious, you know, it just kind of hangs around and creeps in and everything, you know. So we relate everything to the sense of my separateness, myself as a person, how things affect me. And of course, you know, a baby, a child, a baby is really the center of its universe. You know, everything around it impinges on it. It doesn't have much control over the environment. And each one of us are still like that. When you contemplate the existential reality of this moment, each one of us is the center. And not as a person, but as the reality of this moment. Because, you know, whatever you think you are or believe, you know, it's a conditioned attitude, a sense of I'm good, bad, lovable, not lovable, or acceptable or not acceptable. But all of us have to live within this human form that we have, that we're experiencing right now, for the lifetime of this physical body. And of course, that means everything in the universe impinges on this form. Right now, like you're impinging on my vision. But I can't see my face. You can see my face, but I can't see my own face. So that's such an obvious fact, isn't it? It doesn't need to be stated, but it is a reflection, because we tend to operate from the idea that we're all the same. You know, I'm Ajahn Sumedho, you're this person, and, you know, we are human members of this society, etc., etc. And then, you know, we operate in terms of maybe projections, how we remember each other, or things we've heard about each other. So, you know, like people, famous rock stars and celebrities, you know, they get known for all kinds of things, but the actual person sometimes must be completely denied because of all the projections that one might have about some star like Michael Jackson. And think of all the projections and views and opinions about Michael Jackson, who died, you know, but also what was he really, you know, in himself? You know, if you're projecting yourself out to others, you have to have a certain belief in yourself as something or other. So this is why we reflect in this ability to be mindful and to contemplate the realities of this moment. So at this moment, each say, just contemplate the fact that this isn't an ego build-up, is this? That the reality of this moment is each one of you is the center of the universe in terms of experience. You can imagine a center of the universe somewhere out there. Is it the sun, or, you know, even the solar system is in a wider universe. Where is the center of this whole universe? It's beyond any of our abilities to know in any direct way. We can take, you know, what scientists say or others, but in terms of experience, the reality of this present moment is that this is the center. This is the center wherever I am, you know, whether I'm here or somewhere else, alone or with others. Because in this lifetime, that which impinges is the sun, the moon, Mercury, Venus, Mars, all the planets in the universe. I mean, those are the, on the macrocosmic level, are affecting this moment. You know, all the unknown forces in a vast universe. And then there is the temperature of the room, and all the other things that are more tangible at this moment, such as the robe I'm wearing, or this microphone in front of me, or the reactions I might be having, you know, sitting in a prominent position facing all of you. But the point of this is it's the center of the universe. And so this is a good perception to contemplate in your, you know, and reflect from. Not as some kind of I'm God, or, you know, some kind of special person, but each one of us, each creature, in fact, is the center of its universe. You know, so a mosquito for its life, isn't it? It's the center of its universe. Whether it's a dog or a cat or a fish or whatever. So bringing this into consciousness, just to reflect from this, because then when we don't recognize this, then we do get carried away with our thinking process. You know, we have views, opinions, we have ideals, we know how things should be and shouldn't be. We want happiness, we don't want suffering. We want honesty, we don't want dishonesty or corruption in our governments. Right now the big political thing is democracy. We want democracy. And that's what every civilized, decent human being should aim for, is, of course, America's view of democracy. So this is the conditioning process, cultural conditioning. So conditioning then is what you acquire, you know, after you're born. And that world that we live in, we can, you know, say at my age, if I had no insight into Dhamma, then I would be the product of my conditioning. You know, I'd be limited to myself as this old man and this old monk and this old this and the habits, memories of the past and the personal habits, emotional tendencies, which you acquire from childhood can still be, you know, operate as you get older. You know, so it's just these perceptions, these habits are acquired. And so this reflective ability we have to awaken and observe, this is the only way we can resolve the conditioning in a skillful way and not be just helpless victim of our habits, of what we've acquired through cultural conditioning, through our parents, through our social background, etc. Language itself, words, we can give a lot of importance to words, and words can, you know, have a strong effect on whether we're going to be happy or miserable for the day. Because pointing out to one of the novices the other day, I said, you know, in my position as the head monk of this monastery, I could make everybody in this monastery miserable. Just by using words. Nasty words. Where you're just a novice, you might make a few people around you miserable, but you wouldn't have the same effect. So, I mean, this is just... That is reflecting on how important it is for someone like myself to be able to use words skillfully, because they do affect people. And then the intention is to use language, concepts, and words in ways that encourage or lead onward rather than, you know, create fear, anger, resentment, or just give you the wrong message. You know, give you, you know, what I think you are, how I see you according to my view. I could give, you know, opinions about your ability or inability to become enlightened. And then you say, Ajahn Sumedho says, I have no ability for enlightenment. If I told you that. And then that would probably, you know, if you really believe that without question, you know, you would, you know, I would be responsible for giving you the wrong message. You know, I would be feeding you some misinformation that you might cling to because it's coming from what you might regard as an authority figure. So that's why it is important to use language and words, concepts, in a skillful way. I remember when I had first insight into language and thinking, when I was a samanera before I met Ajahn Chah. And of course, my reaction was, I've got to stop thinking. Thinking is bad. I'm going to stop thinking. But try doing that. Just try to stop thinking. And so, you know, I used to spend time, my goodie, just trying to willfully, you know, force my thinking mind to stop. And of course, I couldn't. You know, I could make it kind of stall it for a second or two, and then it all kind of burst forth. So thinking, it's not a put-down of words, thinking, or language, but learning to see them in a proper perspective. So you're not just a helpless victim of your language, your memories, your thoughts, concepts, conditioning. Otherwise, we do become victims of our conditioning. You know, if we get some not very good conditioning, then and we don't question it, then we do see ourselves as, I didn't have the chances as somebody else. I was born, my mother died when I was born, and my father ran away, and I was a pathetic orphan, and I was abused and brutalized in the orphanage. I'm a victim of life. You can justify it, you know, because maybe what the conditioning you acquired was you know, painful and unloving and unkind. But also, even this needn't be an obstruction to enlightenment. You know, being an orphan or not having advantages, social advantages, or proper parenting, if you're willing to reflect and contemplate the present moment, so you can see for yourself, you know, see through the conditioned views, attitudes, emotional habits that you might have acquired through whatever conditioning you've received. So that's where this language is a tool to use, but it's not an end in itself. In modern society, in the Western world, modern Western society, you know, adores analysis and reason and loves to think. And we're all educated, you know, and this is the information age, and we can learn so much about everything. Just through touching a few keys on a computer, and then you know, we learning is you know, learning about things is entertaining, can be an escape, can be skillful, can be used in so many different ways. But no matter how much information you acquire, it's still not this knowing, not this insightful direct knowing of truth. It's maybe knowing what various wise people have said, or religious people have what you've learned from others, other religious people, or teachers, or philosophers. But what the Buddha is suggesting to us is to awaken and see for ourselves. So this is the sati sampajanya emphasis in Buddha's teaching of awakening conscious, using consciousness with awakened attentiveness, and letting go of views and opinions, conditions, not getting rid of them, but no longer trying to interpret your spiritual life through the perceptions of a self or even a convention. So it's learning how to use convention for awakening, for mindfulness. So I've seen this, like the Buddhism, the Theravada Buddhism, the way I developed in Thailand with Ajahn Chah, that kind of practice, how to use this tool, because with Ajahn Chah, very much like he was saying, here's the tool now for seeing clearly, for liberation. And how to use it, helping me, encouraging me to use it. Not just trying to make me into a Buddhist monk. Not, you know, trying to make me into a Thai Buddhist monk. Or a Theravadan, you know, not about Theravadas better than Mahayana or anything like that. There's none of that kind of rubbish. it was use this for awareness, this monastic form, this discipline, and the way that we, you know, and to awaken to life as you're experiencing it in this setting, in this monastery. And so this was a very, very direct teaching, because it, you know, the ego is involved in being a monk, in having an identity. I'm a Theravadin Buddhist monk. I have some kind of name and status to cling to. Even if it's like a bhikkhu, the word bhikkhu is the name for a Buddhist monk. And we can see that as some kind of status, you know, as some kind of priest or Brahmin priest or, you know, somebody, holy person. But what it means is one who depends on alms. So the monastic form, the Buddhist monastic, is based on alms mendicancy. So we have no rights, just freedom to do what we want and eat whenever we want to and do all kinds of things that we can do if we weren't monks. We have to learn to live within the boundaries and the limitation of a very conventional form of what they call vinaya or discipline. And so how to use this for awakening, for awareness, is through reflection. How it, you know, when frustration, because inevitably discipline, restraint is frustrating. You feel frustrated, at least I did. I felt frustrated by the conventions. Because I'm from a very different background, from a kind of hedonistic background of the 60s, early 60s, where you just say whatever you want, you know, I have a right. Right, free speech, so I can say anything. So if I insult you, it's my right to, because this is freedom of speech. You hear this on Radio 4 a lot. How far can you take free speech? and you know, I can take it in a kind of totally selfish way. I'm free to say whatever I want. It's none of your business. If it affects you and hurts you, it's your problem, really, not mine. And that I hear this. But now we're reflecting on how to use speech. Not, you know, if I'm creating problems for you, that may be, you know, your problem also. But it's also my problem, the fact that I'm coming from ignorance, from the self-view, from opinions, from, you know, just projecting onto you my view as if, you know, I'm right and what I say about you is the truth. You know, the kind of conceit, that's conceit, isn't it, and arrogance that we can all recognize in ourselves. So what I've done in this fetters teaching, you know, the ten sangyojana, the first three fetters are the obstructions to stream entry. So in the Theravada style of teaching, you've got stream entry, which is, they call sotapanna, which is where you see the path. You see the Eightfold Path for the first time. You know it. It's a gut knowing. It's not just, I think this is it, or this is, you know, is it, you know, right according to the script. You just, something in you really knows because of the way you've investigated the Four Noble Truths. So then the first three fetters are the obstructions to stream entry. Now this word stream entry in the Buddhist world, because this is a Buddhist term, and it may not mean anything. If you ask a Christian about stream entry, they wouldn't know what you're talking about. So, even though the English word, sotapanna would even mystify them even more. You say, was Jesus Christ a sotapanna? And then like asking if Jesus Christ was gay or something. You know, that you'd understand that better than Sotapanna. But say the but in these this is taking these words out of the Pali scripture, which is a Theravadan language. You know, it's not really a living language, a classical language like Sanskrit. So it has its value in the sense that it isn't one for changing, you know, changing according to fashion and words change their meanings according to, you know, from one generation to another. But Pali kind of is static. And that is a helpful way, a way of using a language like Pali. Not that you have to become scholars or know the language that well, but the terminology sometimes are very helpful using the Pali terms. Because we don't have such a kind of skillful religious language in English. And so we use the Pali and then define the Pali terms with English equivalents. So, anyway, now contemplate this, the fetters that blind us to the path of liberation are the ego, the sense of myself as a separate person. So, what is a separateness? Is that I'm this person, I'm this body here, you know, identity with the body. So, you know, this was, this is a good thing to contemplate. Are you really the body that you identify with? Is it really what you are? And then Ajahn Chah would say, if it was really yours, you could say, don't grow old, and it would obey. So I tried. I said, don't grow old, and look at me now. So I proved the point. And then, did I ask to be born? I don't remember requesting birth. You know, maybe there's something back in history, but at this moment, right, sitting here, right now, I can't remember asking for birth. It happened. So that is, but yet I can say I was born, you know, and I give you the birth date. Because this is the convention of language, and the dates are, you know, what we use are the Christian terminology, so it's 1934. In Buddhist terms, according to Thai calculation, it's 2477. So, let's think, which one is the right one? The Buddhist one? Was I born in 2477 or 1934? Doesn't matter, does it? It's just a convention. There's no reality in it, but just a means we have of recognizing when our parents told us we were born, what the birth certificate suggests or the passport. But is that really me? Is that really a person? And so it's not to take a stand that we haven't any person, you know, or to deny self, but to recognize the conditioned self, that I am 75 years old, is a convention. You know, it's a way of talking. There's nothing wrong with it. But is that really, what is that? That is made up, a human, out of human language, 1934, and I was born, and, you know, I can talk about it as the past. I will die in the future because the body will die. So then we contemplate this body as we're told it's ours and that this is what we look like and so forth, that we acquire a sense of our self through the conditioning process. So with mindfulness, we begin to transcend or to have perspective outside the conditioning process. Now, how can you do that? How can you get any perspective on your ego? It's not through trying to get rid of it or criticize the ego, but to recognize it. And what is the ego based on? It's based on words and concepts and memories. And that I'm Ajahn Sumedho is a convention, and it's a use of English language. I am, that's the pronoun and the verb and the identity, Ajahn Sumedho. Now, I didn't say this when I was born. Not like the Buddha that I'm the chief. That's another one worthy of contemplation. Was that an ego of a little baby? Or was that an actual true statement? And so what that really means is this consciousness, which isn't born, it's not culturally conditioned, it's not personal. And so we begin to recognize, and this is what, you know, this is getting outside the words and concepts that we might have from whatever cultural background, religious background you might have. And this is what the emphasis on sati sampajanya, or mindfulness, awareness, attention, all this implies a sense of being present, opening to this present moment. Beyond the, you know, so we use the words open to the present moment, not as a as something you should do as a person, but it's more like a direction, a pointing. So if I say, you should be more mindful, then what I'm really saying to you is that I don't think you're very mindful, and you're not a very mindful person, and you should be more mindful than you are. And what does that do to you? You say, Ajahn Sumedho always insults me, says I'm not mindful enough, and I just feel discouraged by it. Or, you know, you might feel, you know, that, or you just might rebel and react or believe it. But mindfulness would be when you're actually aware. If I kind of say, you should be more mindful, that awareness of that, how that affects you, that's mindfulness. It's like this. If I scold you and order you to be mindful, and then you're going to feel it, you know, it's going to impinge on your consciousness. But then mindfulness would be recognizing, it's like this. When he spoke to me like that, when he speaks to me like this, I feel like this. And that then you're recognizing the way it is. And then you might go into, he shouldn't speak to me like that, that's not, and then you're back into the ego again. You see, so, you know, Ajahn Sumedho shouldn't order me about, that could go on into, you know, conceptual proliferation, where your just mind wanders at the resentment, anger, and righteous indignation. Or as soon as you wake up to that, you know, like, I'm angry, I'll never forgive Ajahn Sumedho, and suddenly you awaken to that, you begin to recognize and let go of that. You're not going to suppress it or follow it, but just recognize this. You know, I'm never, he shouldn't talk to me like that. It's like this. Then you're beginning to recognize conditioned phenomena from a transcendent position, where you're no longer just helplessly caught in the momentum of emotions or reactions, personal reactions, prejudices, biases, that we or normally are caught into when we're not when we're not mindful, then we're kind of helpless victims of how people look at us or talk to us or body language. Let's contemplate how sensitive being human is. How somebody walks does have its effect on our consciousness. How somebody looks at us or doesn't look at us, if they smile or don't smile, or, you know, whether they're tall or short, fat or thin, male or female, how they're dressed, has an effect on our consciousness. Because this is about sensitivity, isn't it? We're sensitive to the conditioned, to the conditioning that is impinging on us. So this is, so language itself is a critical function that we have. And we, you know, with mindfulness, then we learn how to use the thinking process, not for clinging or grasping, but for pointing. So just say the word Buddha is a word, concept. So that word, you know, with people who aren't Buddhists, who may know nothing about Buddhism, doesn't mean anything. Or they might see it as just some kind of Asian religion. You know, they might have their own particular way of looking at other religions. But as Buddhist meditators, as a Buddhist monk, for example, how to use the word Buddha? Is it just part of, you know, just take it for granted, this is Buddhism, and that, you know, and just, you know, from the, because the books say so and the teacher says this? Or what is Buddha really at this moment? So this is a reflection, isn't it? It's not to try to find a Buddha in this hall, and investigate each one, but to recognize it is for those of us who were not born into Buddhist cultures, you know, it's an acquired knowledge that we usually acquired when we're adults. So when I was a child, Buddhism didn't mean anything to me. But now, having lived as a Buddhist monk for many years, and you developed that, then that concept of Buddha is something that is very skillful. Just the word itself is thinking the word Buddha is a way of reminding myself. It's a beautiful word. It means, you know, awareness. It means the opportunity that we all have to awaken, to be free of ignorance. And it, you know, that's what it really means. It means you can make a Buddha image, like a human figure of Buddha, because what it is it is you know, it's a symbol, it's an icon. It's not Buddha, isn't a Buddha Rupa, but it's an icon, religious icon for mindfulness. So taking that figure, that form, as a way of cultivating awareness, then that's skillfulness, isn't it? Developing skillfulness around the form. I've heard, you know, Western monks, Western Buddhists get on their high horses. They've read this Pali Canon and they take a stand. They shouldn't have Buddha images. There were no Buddha images at the time of the Buddha. And it's just, you know, just superstition. And it can be superstition. We project all kinds of magical powers on the Buddha Rupa and think Buddha is living within that piece of marble behind me. But, you know, that's probably better than thinking a lot of things, but it's still not going to be liberating. So recognize that for me, this word, what I call internalized it. It's a concept, it's a word, just like any other word. But it has a significant meaning because I've taken this word, contemplated how to use it, not for grasping the word in itself, but for using the word for awareness. You know, so just, you know, because we are caught in this sensory experience, you know, we're constantly impinged on and irritated by all the conditions that we have to live with. You know, contemplate this. this realm, this sense realm, we're living on planet Earth, you know, and then it, the weather affects us, the time of day, night, the you know, where we are, whether in London or in Amaravati, or, you know, whether it's spring or winter, summer or autumn, we can, all these things affect us. The people we're with in the office or in the family or the neighbors or the politicians or whatever, they do have an effect on us. And it's like this. So recognize that as being the center of the universe means that you are experiencing inexorable, unrelenting impingement from a vast universe you have no control over, really, but you can open to. And so this is where liberation is not trying to control it or to blindfold yourself. You refuse to look or notice, run away, hide in a cave or something, but to open to it. And then that opening is no longer seen as from the personal, the Sakya Ditti level of I'm opening to the universe, but it's a recognition of the mindfulness of awakened consciousness in this present moment. This is the liberating path from suffering. And the more we begin to recognize this, you know, we're all, you know, mindful in our lives, but we don't recognize it because our lives are so conditioned that we're creatures of habit and we're living for the future or remembering the past. And the present moment can be completely ignored or not reflected upon or recognized because we're working for some result in the future. Or maybe we're caught in a depression where we think about the miserable things that have happened to us, our unfortunate karma and terrible things we've done in the past or terrible things that people have done to us in the past, and then we can get very depressed and, you know, feel life is hopeless, there's no point to it. But that's also in the present. Then for the ones that, you know, in the future holds my destiny, you know, when I make my first billion, or when I get that marvelous position, when I become prime minister, on and on like this, one can always live for the future, or, you know, for the holiday, or whatever, you know, it's not so maniacal as wanting to become king of the world, but it can be. We can live our lives now, do our work, so we can save money for our holiday. And so people, you know, are to buy something, a new car next year. So then our lives are caught up in this time capsule of self. Silabhata Paramasa is another word, the second fetter. It means that's a kind of mouthful, Silabhata Paramasa, and so don't make too much of a problem about it, but it really means the cultural conditioning, social conditioning. It's not so much about the ego, is it? It's about assumptions you have, attitudes that you acquire through cultural identities or social identities. And then the third better is Wicikicca, which is the Pali word translated as doubt, anxiety, isn't it? What holds, what's in the future? We can be, you know, worrying about the future, anxiety about the future is one of the great problems of modern life in societies like this. We don't have to worry about what we're going to eat tomorrow, but we can worry about the economy, about our children, about the state of the world, about the terrorists, or whatever. There's always kind of things to worry about in the future. And so the conditioning is, we're caught in this vortex of conditioning or samsara where It's like a whirlpool. Once you're in it, it's hard to get any perspective on it. It just whirls you about until you awaken to it. So you don't get rid of it. You don't like you kill it nor destroy it. You recognize it. And that recognition then is always in the present moment. It's like this. Even if it's mild, just a feeling of just recognizing a certain mood or a certain thought that arises like this. And that's a beginning, just beginning to, just, you know, getting this sense for sati sampajanya. It's nothing fantastic beyond anyone's ability. But it's so simple that it isn't appreciated by most people. You know, how many of you of you wanted meditation to take you into heavenly realms? You know, I want to practice meditation so I can live in a different realm. And so I tried that, you know, and I began, you know. It would be nice to live in a kind of deva realm, you know, where, you know, the tranquility. When you do concentration practice, you get very refined and very tranquil. And so, I used to like to do a lot of that kind of practice where I just get very sublime and peaceful. And then, you know, because I hadn't developed any wisdom, then getting, when that was disrupted, it was like everything was even worse than before. I'd tasted heaven, but I wasn't living there, a kind of permanent, sustained state, you know. It's very dependent on all kinds of other factors. Where this way is, you know, like the Buddha was pointing to, like the middle way or the Majjhima Paṭipatthana. It's not about heaven or hell or annihilation or eternity, but awakening this simple, imminent reality of now, here and now. And this is, this we hear a lot now, because in countries like this, there's a lot of interest in the here and now, which didn't exist not many years ago. Here and now, it doesn't matter. You know, you work hard for the future. You have any, you know, anything to you. You know, the Americans, we're very much, you know, you work hard so you can, you know, the future is, you know, you set yourself up for the future. You get in there and work hard, workaholic, they call it, addiction to work, for the future. Some kind of ideal state where everything's going to, you're going to get everything you want. And then when you do, even if you do get everything you want, and you've not awakened, you don't know when to stop. You know, you wonder, like some of these very wealthy people, that keep, you know, they get older and older, they keep trying to get more money, even though they've got so much money. It's like they can't stop. Do you need that much money? How much money do you really need? You know, it's way beyond, you know, any need. And then you can hoard it all in a bank, keep it for yourself, not share it out. Because it's like an addiction. It's blinding. So this awakened teaching is you know, this is an ancient teaching. It's not modern psychology or New Age idealism. So it's an ancient teaching, and therefore this is now available in, like here at Amaravati, this the whole point of this monastery is for pointing. Not to convert any of you or make or intimidate you into becoming monks or nuns. Even though some of us might do that to you. Because on a personal level we might think, that, you know, you get that you should be doing what I'm doing, which is Sakyaditi, self-view again. So, you know, this is where you begin to become an expert on Sakyaditi. It doesn't mean you don't ever have it again, but you know it. It's the difference, isn't it, between, you know, like does a arahant have an ego? And then you think, well, what would be an egoless person like? And so, like, Ajahn Chah was a very ebullient, charming person. You know, so he had great humor, he had kind of ebullient personality. And then his successor, Ajahn Liam, is very quiet and restrained. So, you know, Ajahn Chah, when you come into the room, he's kind of open and looks at you and draws you out, and everybody likes that. And then Ajahn Liam, he sits like this and doesn't do anything. And now, which one is the arahant, you know? Or is this just the difference of personality, of karma, and so forth? Do we all have to be ebullient and outgoing? Or maybe some people think Ajahn Chah couldn't be an arahant because he smiles. And according to one interpretation of the scriptures, arahant never smiles. He gives a kind of restrained lifting of the corners. So I remember feeling guilty about smiling, you know, trying to restrain myself. So if you come in and get kind of practice just lifting the corners of my mouth, kind of arahant-like. That's Sakyaditi again, isn't it? So, this is where, the personality operates, like the Dalai Lama. Is he an arahant or what? You know, because he is quite a strong personality. Well, this is, you know, they're using the personality in a skillful way. Like Lung Po Cha one time, I remember, I was there when somebody asked Ajahn Chah about, you know, your charm, you know, you're such a charming, humorous person. And Ajahn Chah said, he called it his magnet. And what he meant was he uses it to draw people in, not for his needs like an ego, like for vanity, but out of compassion, you know, making himself charming and that, because it's natural to him. It's the way his personality is. People are attracted. And then so once they come close, you know, then he can tell when they're ready for Dhamma, you know, whether they just need more charm or they need direction. And Lung Po Liam has his own charm, but if you're comparing him to Ajahn Chah, then you think he doesn't, you know. You could say he looks depressed, maybe. So this is where, you don't trust your own views about, you know, monks or nuns or anything about where they're at, on a, you know, from a personal, judging their personalities. But just recognize that is a tendency to idealize, like arahants are some kind of ideal, some kind of perfect person. But then maybe, you know, when you really look at what an arahant is, when they've gone through those 10 fetters, and the arahant is the term when there's nothing, no clinging, no ignorance, nothing left, the path has been fully cultivated, that would be a completely normal human being. Contemplate that. Most of us aren't normal. We're very, very in various levels of craziness. But arahant would, you know, take into, you know, when you contemplate the 10 fetters, and that perception of an arahant isn't about, you know, some kind of walking on air, flying in the sky magician. It's a human being that is no longer deluded by conditioned realm, who sees things as they are, And that then that is normal. That is the normal norm of consciousness. So this is a, you know, this isn't, this is for reflection, just using these terms. I remember being brought up in a society where everybody said they want you to be normal. Like my parents wanted to be me to be a normal boy. Be normal, not abnormal. And so I wondered really what that was, normal. Because when you're the center of your own universe, you don't think you're normal. At least I didn't. Everybody else seemed more normal than myself. Because I didn't have to live with them 24 hours a day. So I think, what is normal? And then we can feel, you know, because we live with ourselves, and we can see all kinds of faults and weaknesses and flaws in our character, and we can, you know, if get quite depressed by seeing so many things, abnormal qualities or fears of being abnormal, that we, you know, it affects our consciousness and we can't see beyond it. We only live in a realm of fear or anxiety, self-consciousness, feeling of not being good enough, inferiority complexes, and so forth. So, you know, what I've done this afternoon is just trying to bring this to your attention. The invitation is to awaken, and then also to encourage you, say this is within your ability as a human individual. This is not asking you to do something, you know, beyond your ability, but it is an encouragement to awaken to this human state that you're in whatever way you're experiencing it, to see it in terms of through wisdom, through mindfulness and wisdom, rather than through cultural perceptions, conditioned attitudes, emotional habits. So the tea now has appeared on the server, and so I will invite you all to have a cup of tea, and then in 20 minutes or so, if you're interested, we can have a discussion.